The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm still fixing up my pages here. This is Carolyn Yeager, and this is The Heretics Hour. I want to welcome you to tonight's program, which is the 160th continuous weekly edition of The Heretics Hour, and tonight is May 13th, 2013, you know, so I noticed right away those two 13s. For me, 13 is a power number, so I think, you know, we have a powerful program tonight, and we certainly have a powerful guest. He is part of our anniversary theme of prominent white racialist leaders of the past decades who stand out. And so the guest tonight is Tom Metzger. He will be calling in about 5 minutes after. And I also have on with me right now my partner, Tan Stoffel, who I did ask to help me interview Mr. Metzger. And so he agreed to do so. And here we are. Isn't that right, Tom? Tan. I'm going to get mixed up between Tom and Tan. I thought about that.
Well, thanks, Carolyn. Yeah, it's great to be here. It's a pleasure to join you for this to speak with Tom Metzger.
Well, right. And so we thought, you know, and we'd have a little bit of time to say a few things, introduce him a little bit to the listeners and the approach that we're going to have on tonight's program. One thing is that, let's see, what have I got here? Well, yeah, you know, I found that I have some disagreements with Tom Metzger. I've never talked to him. I don't know him at all. He doesn't know me. I don't know what he must know of me somewhat by now. But but since I've been setting up on him, I find myself liking him more and more and agreeing with him more and more. Oh, there's still a couple of issues that's going to be very interesting to bring up. And that is that he calls himself, he sent us a few notes about himself, real brief, but he included in that he was considering himself a white leftist and also a leftist non-Jew socialist. So, you know, that's a bit confusing for me, and that's something that I'm going to want to look into.
Hey, Carolyn, you blanked out there the first sentence, the working class white racist separatist. Your
really?
Audio blanked out for just
a minute. Am I here now?
Yeah.
Just okay, white racist separatist and leftist non-Jew socialist. It may have just blanked out for you, Tan. I don't know.
Yeah, that's possible.
But anyway, you say what you what are you going to be asking?
The rest of what he specified in his email was that he described himself as an anti-war, anti-corporatist, pro-environmentalist, anti-political parties, anti-U.S. government. So this is Tom's own description of himself. And then there's plenty of things that you can find on the internet about Tom Metzger. He's really needs no introduction for most of the people listening, I'm sure. But I think it's interesting to review some of the ways that people describe him. There was a crooksandliars.com article recently about some trouble that Metzger's having, and it was titled "The Feds Are Circling Around White Supremacist Godfather Tom Metzger." And they describe in that article how Metzger has a long and deep lineage in the white supremacist movement and a remarkably broad influence. In many regards, the Minuteman movement of 2005 to 2010 was Metzger's brainchild. I'd like to talk to Tom about that and what he thinks about being given credit for that. Personally, I think what they're trying to do there is just say, you know, we all know Tom Metzger is this really, really, really bad guy, and the Minuteman movement, we want to make sure you know that they're really, really bad guys too. Because from what I know of the Minuteman movement, they were aracial. They opposed immigration. The organization from 2005 to 2010 opposed immigration on a legal basis, you know, a deracinated basis. So, but we'll see what Tom has to say about that. Another article about his run for Congress back in 2010 describes him as white supremacist Tom Metzger campaigns for Congress. He's led the Ku Klux Klan and founded his own white supremacist group. Now Tom Metzger wants to add congressmen to his controversial resume. The 71-year-old.
Well, that's another thing, about him is that he's really into politics. And, you know, I've kind of seen how that's tied in right from the beginning. And he has run for office several times, and he ran this just recently.
In 2010.
But I guess he lost. Right?
Yeah. Well, there's an article here that I could read some bits and pieces from. But just to continue to cover the biographical information, it says that the 71-year-old, and that was as of 2010, so he's got to be 74 now, former KKK Grand Dragon and founder of the White Aryan Resistance, has launched a campaign as a write-in candidate, which, as you say, didn't go so well, I guess. He didn't win. Louis Theroux, in his documentary Louis and the Nazis, claimed that Metzger had been called, and he doesn't say who called him this, but the most dangerous racist in America is how he was described. Now, yeah. One of the things I found intriguing is on Metzger's own site, and I agree with you that as I really dug into what Tom has done over the decades, I found myself simpatico. It very, very much, it's all the right, he says all the right things about the important issues. And in particular, there was this one section at the top of the webpage at his resist.com, and I guess his organization or that website was called The Insurgent at one point in its many transitions. The Insurgent is a network of highly motivated white racists. Each person is an individual leader in his or her own right. The Insurgent promotes the lone wolf tactical concept, made up of individuals and small cells. Each insurgent associate serves the idea that what's good for the white European race is the highest virtue. Whatever is bad for the white European race is the ultimate evil. Each associate works at whatever his or her talents allow. This is the 14 words. And it's also what I like about this, too, is as I've talked about on some of my podcasts, getting into the first principles, really, of racial identity and white identity and morality. And it's about morality at root. And what is your definition of good and evil? And Tom nails it right here in defining it this way in defining his purpose and the purpose that he advocates in this way.
Okay.
And this is what makes him dangerous.
Yes, yeah. Well, I agree. I agree with all that. You know, I'm surprised he hasn't called in already, so I'm quite wondering, because he's communicated several times, and he's very definite what time that he would be calling in. And I don't know if he, you know, he's in Indiana, but he said he's in the Eastern time zone. Is part of Indiana in the Eastern time zone?
I don't know. I hadn't looked into that.
Well, I figured he knows what time zone it is, because I kept giving him the central time zone, and then he said it's 9:05 for me, not 8:05, you know. And so I said, okay, fine.
Right.
But if anybody knows him out there who's listening and can get in touch with him, because I don't even have a phone number for him. He didn't give me one, and I don't have an.
Here, let me send him a quick email.
Okay. And so you can, you know, contact him and tell him he needs to be calling in here, because something has happened and it might be that time thing. I don't know how he could get the time wrong.
Time zone issues.
Yeah, but still, somebody as experienced as him. But anyway, it's too bad, because we're spending time here with no guest. So.
Well, I want to mention that one of the things I would like to talk to him about is this lone wolf idea. I know that you put it in your announcement. So,
Sure we do. I don't know whether to go forward without him here. Are you sending? Of course, he might. I don't know if he gets his emails right away.
Right. Well, there it's sent. So. Okay. Hopefully he'll join us in a minute.
Hopefully somebody who's listening is
phone him,
friends with him. Yeah, call him up and get things going here. I really, you know, sometimes it's so funny, Tan, and with guests, the people that you think you are going to have no problem with, because you know you're just sure that they're right on the ball. Well, it's not always that way, but you know, sometimes it's not that way, and. You know, when I had Glenn Miller on Saturday, well, I knew he would call on time. I just had that feeling. But I also had a feeling with with Tom, so I'm kind of surprised here. But I'm sure he intends to do it unless something came up. So,
well, it was a good show. That Saturday show was very good with Glenn Miller. Another guy. You know, this is a pattern where, as I'm relatively new, as I think you could say the same about yourself, to this movement or these ideas. And yet, as I encounter each of these people that have gone before us in the previous decades, the image that the Jews media paints of them as being these stupid, crazy, evil people that you just don't want to have anything to do with, is the opposite of the truth. They're intelligent people. They've obviously thought very deeply, and they care very deeply about what they're doing. And they're not stupid, crazy, or evil.
Actually, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, we're the best people. We're all the best people, the most intelligent people, and the most people who care the most about what's really important in our lives. So, well, okay, I'll just say that, let's see. I'm sure he's going to call in eventually. You know, he didn't want to use Skype. So he wanted to call. All right, let's see. I hate to bring up the things that I want to ask him. Let me just say that I think he was born in April, Dan, so I think he's now 75 years old. After a 4-year stint in the Army, I don't know if you covered this or not, that's when he says on a little thing he has on his website, that he first came in contact with Negroes because, you know, close contact, I'd say, because he grew up, you know, in kind of a rural, small town, Indiana, at that time. And I can verify that, you know, they're not a part of your life, and you're not in close contact with them at all. And he said he realized that that was something pretty different. You know, they were pretty different. But he just went on, you know, and he didn't get any strong racist, I guess, ideas at that time. But then he moved to California, and he went into he was working at the McDonnell Douglas plant as in electronics, and they were showing anti-communist movies, or somebody was showing them at lunchtime films, and he started watching them. And he got into that, and then he joined the John Birch Society. And that was and in 68 he supported George Wallace for president. So that was his early, you know, experience wherein he got politically active. So he's just a person who is, as some people are, once they become aware of things, they want to do something about it. They get motivated to action, and you know, unlike most people. And right. during the Vietnam War, well, the early part of the Vietnam War, and up until now, when early 70s, 70 to 72, he carried out a tax protest. That is, you know, because he was against the war, he refused to pay taxes. That was going on then. And he lost his television business over that. I don't quite know how. We're going to ask him about that. But by doing that, he met up with lots of other radicals, he says. And that's how he moved on from there. And he, you know, he's right at home, I guess, in radicalism. And from there, in mid-70s, he joined the Ku Klux Klan. And I think that's, I wanted to ask about that, too. At that time, David Duke was the grand dragon of the major Klan, which was the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, KKKK, and he started, he organized, he became the Grand Dragon in California, so the California Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Now, I can see being in the Ku Klux Klan when you're in the South, but I think it's quite a lot more difficult and unusual to become a Klan member when you're outside of the South. All I ever knew about the Klan was that it had a very, very bad reputation and it was ridiculed in the same way that you'd say, you know, because I think now that it has had a very good purpose, but it was feared and ridiculed. So, because these people dressing up in sheets, you know, and that is valid, you know, it is kind of strange, but they had to cover up their identity. And, that was a whole big part of it. So that's how they did it. And they wanted to be in white. And it was a Christian. It was a Christian thing.
Yeah, but, well,
you know, that's
a
big step to take to get into the KKK in California.
Yeah. Your surprise at it not being in the South, I think, is because you're thinking of the first iteration of the Klan during the Reconstruction after the Civil War, the War of Northern Aggression, as a response to defeat is when the first Klan was created. And the second Klan arose, I think it was after the movie or the books, The Birth of a Nation. And it was more widespread in America. It was really kind of a Protestant white American reaction to the influx of Papists, the Catholics, the Eastern and Southern Europeans and Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And so it changed in its nature. And the tail end of that was the, or you could call it the third iteration of the Klan, was the 60s and 70s Klan and beyond.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But still, it's always associated with the South.
Well,
because where there's so many
origins.
Negroes.
Sure.
Well, I don't know. I didn't know there were so many of them in anywhere else.
Initially, it was a black-white thing, but the second iteration in the 1920s was more of a nativist reaction to immigration.
Mm-hmm.
Or not, I don't know, more, but at least that was another element of it.
Okay, so that's why that was the best anti-immigration organization he could join, or he thought the strongest one, the most radical one, and that's what he was really into was anti-immigration. I mean, I'm talking about Tom,
right?
In those days, that was his big motivation. And so, as you know, you were talking about it. He got involved in monitoring the border and so on. So why don't you talk about that? Where is he anyway? Did you hear? You haven't gotten an answer from him, huh?
I haven't checked my email, but yeah, I came back to talk. The paragraph I read was purely an intellectual inspiration, is what it credited him with, inspiring the Minuteman movement in between 2005 and 2010. And I saw part of that firsthand. I wasn't a member of the organization, but I was starting to wake up to what was going on, and I was starting to become politically active again and look around and try and figure out what to do. And the Minutemen was one of those groups that was making the right sounds from my point of view about trying to do something about the problem at the time. And that's what animated me at that time between 2005, 2007 or so, was immigration. You know, this country is not going to exist for too much longer with this many Mexicans flooding into it. It's going to become Mexico. And, you know, this is another pattern that I've
seen. Here he is. Hold on. Let me get onto my Skype page. Keep talking.
Oh, this is another pattern with white racialists, as you saw with Glenn Miller, as we've seen with David Lane's interview.
Oh, shoot. He just disappeared. Or somebody. The call.
Oh, no, I see it. I see it. Here, let me see if I can get it.
Oh, I see it on Skype, but I don't see it on SkyCon. Well, I'll do it anyway. Or are you doing it now?
There is no call 2077, yeah.
Yeah. I've got SkyCon on, and I don't know what that difference. I wonder if
here it comes
again.
You want to do it?
Yeah, let me do it.
Okay.
Maybe he thinks he's supposed to answer right away, and if it doesn't, he hung up, but here he is. Well, we got an undisclosed number, or I hope it's him. I answered it.
It's not going through.
Okay, let me try it again. Must have done something wrong.
That's in progress. Hey, yeah. Tom, are you there? Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can.
All right.
Somehow I had their middle number transposed. I had 433. I don't know how that happened.
Well, I might have sent it to you that way, but I hope not. But anyway, so that's very sorry if I did.
No problem. No problem.
Or you might have done it. I'm not going to take the blame for it, but it could have been. I do that sometimes. Well, I'm just happy that you're here. You know, we were trying to carry on and talk about you without you.
No wonder my ears were burning.
Yeah, so what did you get Tan's email or what? What caused you to finally get it right?
Well, I communicated with my buddy and he told me right number.
Okay.
Good.
All right. Well, okay, well, we're here and we've been talking about your early days. And I was saying that I thought joining the KKK in California and then becoming the leader of it was quite a bold move because I thought that, you know, the KKK was kind of, a Southern thing still, but Tan was telling me that it wasn't by then. And that it was big on anti-immigration. Is that what led you to turn to the KKK at such an early date then?
Well, that was part of it, sure. But actually the Klan, if you'll study the history, was stronger in the 20s in the northern states than in the South, actually.
Well, that's what Tan was telling me. Okay.
There's a good book on that called The KKK in the City that's still around someplace.
Well, I sure didn't know that. But all right, so that was you became Grand Dragon, and you where's this thing that you
I never referred to myself as Grand Dragon. I referred to myself as a state director in California.
Yeah, that sounds better, doesn't it? Some of this terminology is
I never really got excited about those terms.
Okay. In 79, you organized the Klan Border Watch to capture illegal Mexican immigrants. And you had a security force, right?
Well, not to capture them, no, because that would have been illegal. But we had we put patrol cars on the border with radios and so forth. It was an international news story. And we roamed around the border detecting where they were at and turned them in by CB radio to the Border Patrol. And we were taken to court by the Mexican lobby, and the federal judge says, no, they got just as much to travel the highways as you do. So we won in court. But I was on the border many, many times, with Border Watch. We'd get 200 or 300 cars down at the border and go round and round with our lights on, all that kind of stuff. I've been in riots at the border. I had the communists come down and attack me at the border. I spent a lot of time at the border.
Well that was in 79. Go ahead, Tan.
There was an article that gave you credit for inspiring the Minuteman movement of 2005 to 2010. What do you think about that? Did you know any of those fellows doing that?
No, I didn't. I read about them. I heard about them and some of the things they were doing, but I didn't have any direct contact with them. No. Now, remember, I joined the Klan in 75. So in 80, when I ran for office for Congress, then after I had run for office, I left the Klan and formed the White American Political Association.
Mm-hmm.
So after, in 79, was pretty much the peak of my Klan activity, and of course running for office, that was an international story, and then winning the primary in the Democrat Party, that drove them crazy.
I
bumped bellies with Nancy Pelosi several times. She called the cops in to drag me out of the Democrat state convention because I was supposed to have by order of the Secretary of State, 3 seats on the State Central Committee and 3 seats on the County Central Committee. And they denied me my seats. They even brought the cops in to drag me out.
Now, I want to know, Tom, I want to know your relationship to some of these other well-known names in the white racialist movement from back in those days. And, of course, you were associating with David Duke at this time. And what was your relationship with him?
Well, in 75, through other people that I knew, we met in San Diego, and then we met the next day in L.A., and he recruited me in L.A., in North Hollywood, California, mm-hmm. into the Klan. And I went home and told my wife, and she about passed out. She said, "The Klan?"
I bet.
I never would have thought of joining the Klan, but I was very impressed by David Duke as a potential really strong national leader that could take us someplace. So I joined up with him.
Well, I think he was pretty active, and he was going around, traveling around, getting people to do just what he got you to do, and he was being very effective, wasn't he?
Well, so I went to Louisiana. I was his campaign manager when he ran for office the first time in Louisiana for state senate, too.
Really?
And that was in 76 or 7, yes. So I was with him until, about 77, I think it was, when we split company.
Okay, and did you split company over any disagreements, or did you, did you have any, I am trying to get you to say what your opinion of David Duke and his career is and how it's different from yours.
Well, unfortunately, I found that, as far as I'm concerned, David Duke's an amoral person. He will do whatever he has to do to get what he wants, and he can look you right in the eye and tell you a big lie, and you're supposed to accept it. So I didn't like that, so I left. So anyhow, there's a lot of other guys left at the same time, like Louis Beam. So anyhow, he's gone his way, and I've gone mine.
Right. Well, people have said that, so I wanted to get that on the record for myself anyway, whether you had a problem with him. And also already in 77, you decided. But what do you think?
I have more problems with his morality than I did with his politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Well, Tom, I was talking earlier before you came on about morality, one of the things that I really like at your resist.com site is this very simple statement about each insurgent associate serves the idea of what's good for the white European race is the highest virtue, and that whatever's bad for the white European race is the ultimate evil. That's a very sound basis for morality. Now, so your difference with Duke, when you say that he's amoral and you say it's because he lies, was the lie having to do with the white race? You know, was it a disagreement between two men who agreed upon this principle of what's best for whites is what's best, is what's good?
Well, actually, in his books and in his speeches and his writings, he's been pretty straight. However, as the years have gone on in the last 15 years or so, I have left the right wing and have become more to the left. I don't agree with the Jewish left or the Jewish right, but I do find much better pickings as far as recruiting bright young white people out of the left than I do the right. And the right keeps hanging in with the capitalists, and I don't want to do that. I consider myself an Aryan socialist.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, this is another big topic. So why don't we get into that, huh, Carolyn? This
okay.
Left and right stuff. And I see. I'm a little confused because some of the descriptions I've read of you, and maybe some of your own words too. You understand that the left and the right it's false. It's theater. It's not really how the world works. And so it's a little bit surprising to both of us, that to Carolyn and I, that you are so strongly in favor of the left and so down on the right. So could you explain that?
What I'm talking about is different issues of the left tend to go pro-environmentalist, anti-capitalist, anti-international banking, anti-war, military industrial complex and like that most left wingers believe in, and I have no problem with that either, where right wingers tend to say, okay, let's go to war, let's follow Bush, let's jump into Iraq, let's join up and fight and kill people in other countries. And
talking about the mainstream when you say that? You know, you're talking about the mainstream right and the mainstream left, or maybe the Council of Conservative Citizens or something is the right, rather than the true racist white racist, right?
Yeah, there's a lot. There's quite a bit of difference there, but generally, I just am having more and more a problem dealing with the right. Generally, the right, and so I'm picking up more and more good information from leftist sources. Now, I'm talking about radical leftists, not the run-of-the-mill Jewish-controlled leftists. I'm talking about radical leftists who disagree on the race issue, but on other issues are pretty damn good.
Yeah, but see, that is, to me, where the real rubber hits the road really bad is that they disagree on race issues, and they always will. And if you're basically a racialist, a white race, and you seem to be, then I don't see where that fits in.
It fits in because since 1980s, I've recruited a whole lot of people from the left for years.
Well, what are they doing? You're fighting corporate. You're fighting government, right, or something like that? They're animals.
Yeah, of course.
I don't.
Of course,
like
I'm fighting.
Yeah, well, you're not. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Government's controlled by the capitalists and the moneymakers and. And the government, the politicians, are simply pawns in the game. I don't see why any left or right winger, either one, should disagree with that.
Well, see, you're dividing it into left and right, and I try to divide it. It's racial, and to fight immigration, we have to use the white racial argument. We have to get people
That's
to
true.
Be white racialists.
That's true. I hate right and left terms too, but. Let me put it this way. We're in class war too. And if we're not in class war, we're in nothing because there's been a class war since year one by the elite rich whites against the white working class poor and the peasants. Always has been through the kings right down through the ages, right down through our founding fathers and so forth. While they were saying, well, we're going to release the slaves, but we're going to enslave the white working class into wage slavery. So, I'm a big Jack London fan myself. If you read The Iron Heel.
I have not.
I haven't either.
Yeah, it's a good book to read. You see, racism in this country, when you go back, even beyond the turn of the last century, was left. It was populist. It wasn't right wing. Right wing was the rich guys.
Yeah.
Well, class warfare is Marxist. Come on, Tom. You know, can't get away from that.
No, class warfare is also other sources too. Well, let me put it this way, without driving everybody crazy: not everything Marx said was wrong.
Oh, there we go.
You see, everybody says some truth.
Yeah.
And so when a person says, well, these capitalists are controlling 1 or 2% of the people. Owning and controlling most of the wealth in the world. Well, I can't disagree with that because you can prove that's right. In this country, the wealthy control more than half of the income of the poor and the working class in a year. I mean, you know, I can't disagree with that. If I find truth, I'm going to say, yeah, that's truth.
Well, right, but how about this truth? When you use class warfare, you're dividing, people of the same race. And do you only allow white people in your organization, or you don't even have one? So are you just talking?
No.
But what are you trying to form there? Because you're going to have all kinds of non-whites.
I'm not using class warfare. Class warfare has been used against the white race for hundreds of years, perhaps thousands, through many means. So when I defend myself against the class warfare of the rich, don't say I'm using class warfare. I'm defending myself from the ultimate rich, elitist, Jew, capitalist oppressors as far
well,
as
let
I'm
me
concerned.
Say, let me say you're dividing people according to class, okay? And you're saying that the working class is good and the wealthy class is bad. And, you know, I don't idealize the working class the way that you do.
Well, I don't idealize anybody, but the point is, how many rich people support you? How many wealthy people support the racialist cause? I don't know any.
Oh, I'm sure there's some that do. There always was.
Well,
there always has been.
No, there never was. unless it benefited the rich people themselves. If they could use the right wing, and they have used the right wing against the working class many times, and so yeah, they'll do that. But I see absolutely no wealthy person supporting our cause. I'm talking about really wealthy. I'm not talking about just people who have some money.
Well, there have been wealthy people who have left endowments to things, but usually they've been mishandled by people on the right.
How many endowments are you aware of to anybody?
Well, I'm just thinking about that one to the IHR back in the 80s. They screwed that up because they fight among themselves.
Well, no, I know all about that. I was right in the middle. I know what was going on there. That was the Edison fortune. But that was still somewhat elitist because her attitude, and the attitude of much of the right wing is elitist. And even Duke and people like that, their attitude is elitist. I remember when he said, "I don't mess with the Klan anymore. They had too much green tea." He had a contempt for the working class.
Well, even though he used tea?
I wouldn't go around calling poor people, working people, people with green teeth. I haven't seen anybody around here that's working class with green teeth.
Well, I haven't either. No, I wouldn't either. But that was not a very nice thing to say. But
that was his attitude, and it's elitist attitude. Of course, his father was a big person in Shell Oil, and he worked for the CIA and all that kind of stuff. So he has an elitist attitude, even though he tried. So many working class people follow him, but that's their business.
There are a lot of people that are not working class who are very, very good people, you know. And so when you kind of divide it up that way, I don't see how you're gonna. And I want to be quiet and let Tan talk to you, but I don't see how you can keep a white racist. And you keep saying you're a white racist, and you certainly sound like it and act like it. How you keep a white racist sense about what you're doing when you want to make the working class versus the elite class? And it's not really that way, because there's all that middle class is, you know, in between, that we need to have. Well, there used to be a middle class, and you wouldn't have liked that either, because he's a bourgeois. They went along.
Well, no, I have nothing against the middle class, except they're lazy and they don't vote right, and they.
Well, do you think working class people are not lazy? I don't know.
I don't see working class
people doing a lot.
Well, if they're working class, they're working their ass off or working two or three jobs.
Too many people who politically promote working class are not working class themselves.
Well, I'm not talking about the lumpen proletariat that Marx talked about, that we're lower than the working class. I'm talking about the working class, people who work every day, one, two, three jobs a day, and work themselves sick. That's the working class. Now, they can be white collar and all that too. I mean, I'm not saying they got to be blue collar and working in a foundry, but the lumpen proletariat is the poor and most of the Negro race and so forth like that.
Well, it's not fitting together for me. What do you say, Tan?
Well, I struggled with this myself just in reading what you how you've been described and what you've had to say yourself, Tom. There's a lot of truth in what you're saying, and I agree with much of it. But what disturbs me a little bit is I have a more holistic idea. What you're saying about the green teeth comment turning off working class people, I think, you know, the wealthy are turned off by the animosity that comes from the working class. I think part of our problem is this division between the brain and the body. And there is a lot of truth in the idea that the brain, it's the aristocracy or the, you know, the people who are intelligent enough and should be leading us, who have betrayed us. It's not the body that has betrayed.
They've always betrayed.
That's a good point.
When haven't they betrayed? Look at all the wars where millions of our people have died because they've been misled and betrayed by the industrial complex and the military-industrial complex and the generals and all that. Civil War, Revolutionary War, all of it has been a racket money-making racket.
But you know, a lot of these people have been unable and unwilling to see through it, and they jump to that as fast as they can. They like it because it works for them. They want to go and fight somebody, or they want to, they want to have this patriotism and so on. There's way too easily fooled. And a lot of working people, if you gave them some of what the wealthier people had, they would be just like them. They really would be.
Yes, they would. I don't know why you're misconstruing what I'm saying. I believe in human nature, and I believe there can be, I'm not worshiping the working class. I'm just saying the working class is the giant amount of the white race, and these are people who work every day really hard, trying to support a family, trying to keep it together. Sometimes they run up and join the army because they can't get a job, or they can't get into school, or and the Mexicans are taking their jobs, or the blacks are taking their jobs. A good share of people joining military now are just trying to survive.
Yeah.
Well, what about the Jews? Because, you know, the liberals, the leftists that I know, always want to talk about the corporations and the rich elites and the rich whites and the rich Republicans and conservatives and how much they hate them and so on, very much like you do. And they will not talk about the Jews, of course. And not you've been so anti-Jewish. You definitely are, and yet you haven't brought that up tonight yet.
Well, you haven't asked me.
Well, I'm asking you now.
What do you think I want to do with the Jews? Well, execute the criminal Jews, and if the others become tame, as George Lincoln Rockwell used to say, leave them alone. But the criminals of the Jewish group, which is a conspiracy, not a race, then punish them, hang them, execute them, and all the rest of the Aryan criminals and crooked people in government and business the same way.
Okay, so now the Jews are not a race, according to you. So do you think Jews are white?
Of course
they're
not
a race.
Are Jews
among the white people?
The Jews marry into other races, and that's how they get their power. They gene hijack. That's what they do. And the Jews weren't that big. They weren't that big a deal until they gene hijacked their way into the European race and primarily to the German race of people. And then they got some good genes in them, and they got powerful.
Well, what kept them together as Jews? Why did they do what they do, and why are they still want to be Jews? I mean, why don't they just join?
Conspiracy and power. That's all it ever was. Conspiracy and power. And they have discovered a means of deception and so forth, and they've honed that down through the years as a minority. And, of course, they've used anti-Jewish programs to sort of drive them together to get them back in line. Which they do all the time, and so they become a very hard, fast, intelligent, through gene hijacking group of people who have a will to power. And it's simple as that. Judaism.
Well, where's our will to power? Where's our white will to power?
They're all in prison.
Oh, yeah. Come on.
Well, some of the best are in prison. If I could open the doors of the prisons and bring out the collective intelligence and strength from those prisons, we'd get someplace.
Skinheads, they are the cream.
There's geniuses in prison. And I'm not talking about just skinheads, but there's a lot of intelligent skinheads too, except they got taken too far to the right. That's why I told them back in the 80s, I said, we got to quit the skinhead thing. You got to put on a suit. You got to get into the military. You got to get into the police. You got to get into the government and be our underground. And a lot of them did. And a lot of them didn't. A lot of them are still doing the same old stupid stuff, and they go to prison for it. And they come out of prison and they write me and say, I wish I'd have listened to you. But I'm talking about, I have known geniuses that are languished in prison, that inventors and chemists and all kinds of people, literary people, all kinds of people, through one reason or another, they're in prison. And if you could bring them out, they would be a potential army. I'm not saying that I want to recruit just for prisons. I'm just saying they're there, and they're just being warehoused. You know, like, was it Rockwell used to say, the path to the palace is through the dungeons, you know? And so it's no shame to go to prison if you go for the right reasons.
Okay, so the problem with the white race, why we don't have the will to power, is because all of our best people are in prison. That's basically what you're saying.
I'm saying we have the will to power, but the other part of the white race has plenty of will to power. That's why they're running the show. They're, you know, it tickles me when I laugh with a black guy who says, what are you talking about, white power? It's white power up there, and also with the Jews running the show. All our the strongest people of our race have sold out. They're at the top. They've got all the money, and they ain't going to share it with you for nothing. And they're not going to finance anything you're doing. That, you know, if you got more than $1,000 from a contributor, that would be a really great day, wouldn't it?
Tan, do you want to?
Well, I want to say that there's a lot of truth in what Tom is saying. I find myself agreeing.
Pardon me? Asking Tan if he knew there are a lot of people in prison that were.
No, I don't know a lot of people in prison. I don't. I know people in the police. I know people in the military, in my own family. But there is truth in what he's saying. The brain, the aristocracy of the white race has betrayed the white race, got into bed with the Jews, and we have philosopher warriors like Tom is a great example, David Lane, Robert Matthews, even William Pierce, although William Pierce could have been a member of the elite, could have been a member of this aristocracy. There are people that will rise up from the gene pool to replace this aristocracy that has abandoned us, that has betrayed us. But a lot of them are in prison. I have no doubt about that. Or they kill themselves with drugs because they can't stand the harsh reality of what's going on.
Let me tell you, can I tell you a little story about power? When
yes,
I
please.
Ran for Congress, and I won the Democratic nomination, all of a sudden I had all kinds of people coming to me wanting this and that and all this kind of stuff. And I was invited to a top-level meeting in Redwood City in outside San Francisco. We had an ex-Republican cabinet member there. We had a congressman there. We had several dignitaries, including some police officers and so forth, set me down at the table and said, Tom, we like you. We like what you're saying. And if you'll go with us and take our program, we'll push you all the way. And that was when Reagan was in. I said, well, what's your program? They laid it out for him, and I said, there's no way I'm going to do that. That's not me. And I walked out. The program was go along with the program.
Along to get along. It's a Jewish thing. Go along to get along.
That's right. Yeah, you do that and you'll have all our support. Well, and then I had it on the other side. I went to a cocktail party in Southern California there at, I forget the name of the city down there. But anyhow, it was a pool party and I walked in with my security people and two or three, and my son, and I'm at one end of the pool, and all these regular party toadies ran to the other end of the pool. The ex-governor of California, Pat Brown, which some of the older people may remember, who was a pretty good guy, really, compared to what we got now, he came up to me, the only one that would come around that pool, put his arm around me and said, Tom, whispered in my ear, you've got a hell of a career if you just stop this race stuff. So I got it from both sides, and I learned right there. And then when Nancy Pelosi had me dragged out of the State Central Committee after I had every legitimate reason to be there with my two people that I appointed, I learned what politics was all about, and I said, we'll never win it this way. It's going to have to be a war. And you're not going to vote them in. You're not going to get voted in. You're not going to get these rich bastards to support you. You're going to have to kick ass. And that's what I believe.
Yeah.
You can't trust the rich.
But do you think that we could ever have the power to, without being able to get political power, that we would ever have the power to win in a war?
Well, Mao Zedong did pretty good. Remember what he said? Power comes out of the end of the gun. Revolution has got to start someplace. We need a revolution. We need a civil war. And if we don't have that, well, then we just have to revert to tribalism and go our separate ways into the mountains, into the deserts, or whatever, because we'll be we can't stand as a united front against these people, because they've got the whole military and police apparatus against us.
So you got to make it. So you're joining with non-whites, basically. I think you probably are, because you say all these people you're talking to, leftists, you don't know what they are, and now let's get into this real quick.
Sure, I know who they are. I'm talking white leftists, and I've sat down with black.
But they're not racist themselves, even though they're white.
Yes, well, a lot of them are, but anyhow, I've sat down with black groups for 20 years. I've had meetings with black separatist groups, and I've told them before, to a standing ovation to the new Black Panther Party, I said, you attack Washington from your where you're at, and we'll attack Washington from where I'm at. And that's it. We're not going to be together, but we know we hate the government.
Well, okay, so it's an anti-government thing, and there are other people who think about it that way, too. Now, let me bring up Louis Beam instead of going where I was going to go. Because he's very anti-government, and you knew him. What was your relationship? Tell us about how well you knew him and what you know about him.
Well, back in the old days, we were very close friends. I haven't talked to Louis for many years. I don't know exactly what he's into, but I know he's still active. So last time I met with Louis Beam was after the order had been arrested, and I met him in Idaho. We had a talk. So, but anyhow, we both agree on the system of leaderless resistance, which I call going on into lone wolf operations. We can't have organizations and card-carrying organizations anymore. We can't even have meetings unless you're stupid.
Right. So then the thing I wanted to bring up was that if you have a lone wolf, you don't know whether people are doing anything or not. And if they're not supposed to be, you know, communicating that much about what they're doing, then we really don't have any way of knowing this in this leaderless idea, whether people are doing anything at all or just like.
Well, I know what the right wing is doing now. They're doing nothing. If one lone wolf does something, that's better than the whole right wing that just sit around and flap their gums.
Well, I still think people look to a leader and want a leader, but it's hard for any leader to get any foothold because right away, the government is so harsh in a way that it didn't have the kind of power in the old days that it has now, that it has in the United States.
The conditions are not right yet. The conditions are not right. You can't force something to happen before its time. Throughout history, there's been turning points when revolution and so forth happened. You can't force it, though. You have to wait for the proper time, and conditions will cause it. And number one, it's up to our oppressors to do it to us. I want them to try to take all the guns. I want them, they say, well, they're going to put us in FEMA camps. Good. Put these bastards in white in a FEMA camp. Maybe they'll wake up to what they got to do.
Well, if they wake up, then how are they going to get out? I really don't think. I think to talk like that is a little bit. And not looking at the reality of it, because you can never get out again. No, you're just talking about the guys in prison.
Yeah, well, then we break them out, just like Red Dawn.
Oh,
remember
sure.
The movie?
Wow.
Okay, that's happened over throughout the world many times. There's been penal colonies and prison camps, and the revolutionaries in the underground cut the wire and broke them out, and then they went crazy, and that's what we need to, if that happens. But I'm of the position the whole country is a FEMA camp. They don't need to put anybody in a FEMA camp. We're all in a FEMA camp right now.
Right. Yeah, we're voluntarily, and they know how to do that. I think that's the biggest problem that we have, and people need to understand, and that's what we have to break through, is that we are conditioned to go along, and we think that we have freedom when we're actually, in a big FEMA camp. And so this I think this should be the message, basically,
Well, let me boil it down to something very simple. Over at the Gibraltar, in Gibraltar, there's some woods and so forth, and and there's these Gibraltar apes, and people used to hunt them. And the way they hunted them is they went into the woods and they hung a cage up, hanging down, and in the middle of the cage there'd be an apple. And the bars were just wide enough for the ape to get his paw in there and get a hold of that apple, but not enough room to get it out. And here the hunter would come the next day, and there'd be that ape screaming and yelling and everything, but he's holding on to that apple. And that's what the American people are doing, the white race is doing.
That's right.
Trying to hold on to that apple is going to lose its whole arm.
Yeah. Yeah, I've experienced that in myself, in small things where I didn't want to give up something that I wanted, that I had got hold of, but it really, yeah, you're very right. These kind of things are human nature and human weaknesses, and they know what they are, and we haven't figured that out. Well, Tan, you've been very quiet. We've got 60 seconds before the break. Join in here.
Well, please stay with us, Tom, through the break and join us on the other side. Sure. What you're saying makes a lot of sense to me. I want to talk more about Lewis Beam, leaderless resistance, and your concept of lone wolves.
Yeah, that came out of that was a Cuban general that came up with leaderless resistance. It wasn't Lewis Beam or Tom Metzger, even though we both started talking about it at the same time. It was a Cuban general that was opposed to Batista, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm. Was that Colonel Amos?
I think it was. I had a booklet about it, but I think I've lost it in my travels.
Right.
So, yeah, it was. Do you? That's what Beam says. Do you consider that you and Beam came up with that right at the same time?
Yeah, just about. I mean, I might even have been first, but I'm not going to argue about it. I'm glad that Beam came up with it, and I'm glad that I promoted it too.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, stay with us. We're here with Tom Metzger, and we'll be back in 5 minutes.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten, und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken im Massengrab und im Meer. Aber es leben Halunken und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie einen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als die. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Thank you. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt, was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Und welche Erbärmlichkeit!
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour on May 13th, 2013, and I'm here with Tom Metzger and Tan Stoffel. And Tan Stoffel, why don't you take over here for a while and talk about the things you wanted to talk about with Tom?
Sure. Well, I wanted to praise you, Tom, because you're one of these guys who seems to be able to boil things down to very simple, easy to remember, and obviously true statements. The ADL page on you starts off quoting you as saying, tolerance is suicide, which is a true statement. And I would only say maybe imposed tolerance is genocide. To improve on that or complement that. Other things that I recall hearing, and I don't have any direct quotes, but little pieces, bits of wisdom that I credit to you, and you could tell me if I'm right or wrong in crediting you, but one of the things I remember early on is you said something like, I wasn't a racist to start with. It was being called a racist over and over that made me into a racist. And
In fact, I went beyond that. I said, if the government doesn't like me, they shouldn't have created me. Because every step of the way, the pressure and the persecution of the Jews and the government is what built me into what I am today.
Yeah, that's the essence.
When I started out, I was just a little lollyleg, you know, Republican-type conservative that thought that, the Cold War was wonderful. We got to get the Russians and nuke them and everything and all that stuff all those years. And finally, I got my head on straight, you know.
Right. And if anything, you feel suckered by that you were defrauded.
Right. I spent a lot of my own hard-earned money on it, too. I didn't have a lot of money, but I spent a lot of it on the right wing. And one thing to remember, I keep trying to remind people, in the early 30s or late 20s, who was in the streets getting their ass beaten and killed? It was the real National Socialists, not the ones that came later. The real National Socialists that were fighting the Jew communists in the street and the Jew right wing in the street, and they were being murdered all over the place. Today, these phony Hollywood National Socialists, all they want to do is run World War II films about how wonderful the Wehrmacht was. I go back before and what came out of the brown shirts and 5 million men army of brown shirts that came out of the streets, the working class, fighting both sides, fighting the right and the left, fighting the communists and the right, you see. And that's what we need to understand, is this is not, we are different. We're not, we should not be right wing. We should not be communist left, you know. But we should come together. You know, in Germany, there's a law that says it's against the law in Germany for the right and left to conspire to take power.
No,
that's what they've done.
I read that a long time ago, and I said, hey, well, that's what we should be doing. You know, the trouble the right way, they want to march up the hill like Lee did at Gettysburg, get their ass whipped, instead of using deception and trickery and infiltration and deceit and all the things they cry about for the Jews that are weapons that the white race should be using.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Well, it's back to this left-right thing again, and my feeling about that is I wish we could transcend it. I wish we could transcend this division between left and right. And I agree with you, though, that the history teaches a different lesson, that that they've always betrayed us. But I would just say it's not the right that's betrayed the left. It's the people with power who think that they can get along on their own. They abandon their nation. They abandon their people because they think they don't need their people or their nation. And that's right. The psychological mechanism behind it. It's a temptation.
It's gradually coming down to the wire, so I tell everybody out there, hey, don't get excited. It's coming. You know, don't worry about it. We're going to get there pretty soon, you know, hopefully before I kick the bucket. But the system's eating its tail. It's going to become more oppressive. The rich are getting richer by the minute. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, trillions of that banking deal on Wall Street. They took us totally, the cleaners, the Jews.
It's all Jews. It's mainly There's not that many lackeys.
No, I know. I got friends like that. Everything's Jews. Everything's Jews. Well, sure, the Jews are a big part of it. But if you stop at the Jews, they're people in power. Aryan traitors, that if their ass was really against the wall, they'd probably tell us, okay, go get the Jews, and then they'd still be in power. If you shipped all the Jews to Mars tomorrow, we'd still have a problem.
These Aryans that are in power are doing the will of the Jews. If they weren't doing the will of the Jews, they wouldn't be in power, but they do. You're right. They're lackeys, but they're not the ones in control. They're not the truest enemy.
It gets a little confusing because through gene hijacking, the Jews are in all the races and all the monarchies and for that reason,
we just have to overlook. You know, basically overlook. You know, on your website, you've got that archive of A. Wyatt Mann cartoons, and those are really far out, extremely what would be considered vilely racist and hateful.
Yeah.
And why do you keep that on there? Because it attracts people and you get lots of people enjoy looking at them. And
it's precious. I love that stuff. It's a picture's worth a thousand words.
We put them up and take them. Sometimes we take them down for a while and then put them back up. But those cartoons are all over the world. People have adopted those cartoons. I'm seeing all these groups all over the country are using those cartoons.
Well, I know. I've seen all those cartoons before I saw them on your site. But I'm just saying, if you're not so much against the Jews, why do you have that up there? You've got a whole page that's filled with all this real strong anti-Jew stuff.
I'm saying the hierarchy of the Jews are like that. They even look
like
that.
You know, in these cartoons, it's not these rich hierarchy. It's ordinary-looking kind of Jews, right?
I don't know about that. I didn't make those cartoons, and I can't draw anything. But anyhow, I don't think we did have any Jews with tuxedos on, but maybe I can get my cartoonist to do that too. But I like to stick in their eye and say, hey, come on out, boy. You want to fight? Come on out. Here's what we think of you. Come on out and fight.
I agree.
We're not afraid of Jews. This fear of Jews upsets me all the time. The Jews, the Jews, the Jews are for power. The Jews are power. 1-2% of the world. Look, one SS man could walk down the street and take care of 200 Jews. So this idea that we can't take the Jews out or the Jews that are causing all the trouble is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. The right wing builds the Jews into a super colossus like
the right wing that does it. It's the right wing is not doing that.
What is the right wing anymore?
That's it. That's right. You know, as I said earlier, you're talking about people who I don't even consider part of our movement. They're not white racialists, really. They're just kind of, but they're people like Council of Conservative Citizens and so on, who are kind of weak, you know. They're basically just anti-black. You know, I've got this thing.
They're just like the White Citizens Council. They were cowardly businessmen, Republicans, or guys with a lot of money, wanted to save their money instead of saving the white race in the South. So they had people like Wallace who turned his back on us, and all those governors actually turned their back on the white race. You can't trust people. The minute they get some money and get some power, I'm telling you, you can't trust
them.
People
are like that, and all your working class people are the same way, and that's, people are like that, and you can't divide them, you know, and say that, oh, the working class is doesn't.
The working class doesn't have the money and the power to do that. They can be stupid and do wrong things.
Neither does the middle class, you know.
There is no more middle class. It's gone.
Yeah.
It's gone. If you don't have enough money to live for an entire year without borrowing it or taking it from somebody else, you're not middle class. How many people could live a year?
Lots of people.
Oh, yeah? How many people
do
you call middle class? With their mortgages and their house payments and their car payments and all that, could live with a year without having an income?
Isn't Tan middle class? Aren't you middle class, Tan?
Everybody considers themselves middle class. That's one of the truisms
right.
of sociology. But
it's an illusion.
Yeah, it is partly illusion that even lower class people think of themselves as middle class. Even wealthy people think of themselves as middle class. It's an appealing idea that you're just an everyman. You're the common average man. It's part of the psychological projection. The fundamental law of psychology, human psychology, is to imagine. It's a positive projection, really, imagining you're just like everybody else.
What it is the big sheep pen.
A sign of domestication, yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of the middle class, I remember thinking this way too when I was younger. I said, boy, I can become rich too, and I'll become rich and all that, you know. A lot of the middle class are just jealous of the rich class.
That's a good point, yeah. That the middle class is just the lower class people who want to be in the upper class, who think they can be.
And working class would too. I think that Carolyn gets me a little wrong. I don't worship the working class. I know human nature is human nature. But I'm saying there's a hell of a lot more of them and white people that are working class that we need to worry about than the super rich. I mean, you know,
naturally. Where is this going? I mean, I find it. I don't like anything that gets friendly with the left. I just don't. I know there are a lot. See, that's very popular now. There are a lot of people advocating.
I hear the same thing from the other side. You know, I talk to all these people on both sides, and I wish people just quit using left and right. And I remember back years ago when, after the Vietnam War, some of my people in the Klan were up in Northern California, up there in the woods raising pot with all the left-wingers, and the right-wingers were all up there raising pot. And in the wintertime, they get together in a cabin and around the fire and talk about it. And they said, hell, we're talking the same thing. We're just using different terms. We got
How would you handle it? How would we get rid of the left and the right? How would you do it? Would we use?
Well, it's very simple. If I hear something from somebody allegedly is on the left that makes sense and it's the truth, I put it on my show or I put it on my website. If I hear something from somebody who says they're on the right and it's correct and it's true, I put it on my website or put it on my radio show. So I've had some pretty radical leftist stuff on my show. And, I mean, you know, there's a lot of writers from the left that I've respected and so forth like that. So it's a lot more complicated than the right wing want to make it.
What do you say, Tim?
I agree.
Well, you just keep agreeing.
I do. I started off on the right, and so I see your point of view, and I have a sort of affinity for right-wing conservatives. I sympathize even with the Tea Partiers, bless their hearts. They're the deracinated white people just trying to reduce the size of government. I understand because that's where I came from, and I used to think that way, and I guess – and I also see, you know, Tom and other, this is part of the pattern of other white leaders have been through so many different organizations looking for a solution. So, you know, I'm willing to listen to his wisdom on this point. And
You wanted to talk about something.
Well, yeah, I wanted to touch on another aphorism, a little witticism of Tom's about the police are not our friends, and don't trust them, and his five-word I have nothing to say advice. And this – we're coming, I think, to this crunch, this it's going to happen here, what Tom was talking about. And the police and the military are becoming less and less white, and we've had it good up until now in that they are white, and even though they may be deracinated or even anti-racist, they're and hostile to us, they're not as hostile to us as a non-white military and non-white police are going to be. And if you could talk about that a little bit, about how do you feel about this? You're a blue-collar, sympathizing guy, and yet at the same time you realize that what the police are doing, who they're working for, is bad and evil for us.
Well, I approach a cop just like I would a guy working in a gas station. If I can trust him, fine. I have no problem with him. If I can't trust him, he's the enemy. And if you want to know who somebody's working for, you look at the bottom of their check and see who signs it. The system signs the cop's check, so they're going to serve the system first, whether it's a local cop or a federal cop. I mean, they're getting paid by the system, so they tend to go with the system.
Yeah.
And so I've had associations with police who come around, and they treat me as a gentlemanly fashion. I treat them in a gentlemanly fashion, but I'm not afraid of them, and I'm not going to bow down to them. I don't have any more respect for a cop than I do a common carpenter.
Right. I think that's a good point, and I would apply the same logic to a wealthy white banker or a wealthy white business owner. They answer to the power of that of being punished by having that wealth and that power taken away from them if they were to raise their hand against it. So they go along with the system in the same way that the cop does.
Well, let me suggest something. Then, you know how the people who fight forest fires work? There's a big forest fire coming up one side of the mountain, and the only way to stop it is start a fire up the other side of the mountain. Then the banker is going to have to decide who he's going to go with, the people or Wall Street. It has to come down to that. I was watching a documentary this evening on Russia TV, and I've seen it before, about this celebration of the Burning Man out in Nevada every year. It's a bizarre situation. Thousands of people come out there dressed all funny like a bunch of hippies but heathens and everything. But the one guy says in there, he says, you know, we got to get the Tea Party and these other people on the left together. We got to get this going. We got to get the Occupy people and the Tea Party people together. And I said, this man has got, that's the way to go. You got to get them together and start getting a common language. You can't sit over there and just say, well, those goddamn leftists, they're no good. And then the leftists over there, oh, goddamn rightists are no good. You got to pick out people that are worthy of respect and work with them and forget the right-left thing.
Doing that besides yourself? Is there anybody
that? Not many, I'll tell you. I've been working at it for quite a while. But I think there is in the younger guys. I hear them on the radio here talking quite a bit. I think they're evolving. It took me a long time to evolve. I mean, I went through, boy, I'm telling you, even, you know, Chris, I had to bail out of Christianity and the whole bit, but I've evolved. And
you were even Christian Identity.
I was.
Yeah.
I was Christian when I was in the,
And sure, a lot of people in the white movement were.
Well, I have a lot of respect for a lot of the people that were Christian Identity. I knew all the leaders. They were friends of mine. Even after I began, even after I left the Christian idea, I still, you know, Reverend Butler of Varying Nations was my friend. Robert Miles in Michigan was my friend. Herbert Compere from San Diego, all these guys, Colonel William Gale, I knew them all. They're all my friends. And these guys were willing to fight to the death for their race, and I respect them for that.
Well, I do too. And what do you what do you think of those today who attack Christianity in that kind of nasty way. You know, do you think Christianity is a Jewish movement and things like that?
Well, of course it is. I mean,
do you think it was invented by the Jews? First you say that the Jews are just a bunch of people trying to come in and marry. They're not anything, you know, they're not a race.
Well, the mixed multitude came out of Egypt. They went all over the place, and they got down there in Rome and screwed up the Roman Empire. And Constantine made Christianity the religion of the empire, even though he was never a Christian himself. But Christianity is Christ's insanity. Christ never existed. He's simply a symbolism of the sun. And if you go back and study ancient religion, you'll find out where it come from.
Negate it. All religions are created out of ideas that people have.
Well, our main enemy today is not Islam. That's over there. Our main enemy today is this crazy ass evangelical Christianity that's so pro-kike it's unbelievable.
Well, I disagree with you there. You know, I think to say, oh, there's nothing wrong with Islam. Islam is fine, or somebody's, Christianity is the problem. While you're answering that, I just want to say that somebody's trying to call with an undisclosed number, and I'm not going to answer it because I've said that I will not take any undisclosed phone numbers. So
I didn't say Islam is not our enemy. It's but left in peace, and if the capitalists and the people imperialists hadn't gone in there over oil and stirred up the crap, which they continually do, Islam would be relatively peaceful. But I mean, you know, if we have to kill Islam,
they still want to get into Europe, and they still are wanting to get more and more into the United States.
Well who's inviting them in? And who's causing the problems in these countries to where the people flee the country to go any place and get to the United States or any place else? They're fleeing capitalist exploitation in the industrial complex. You would too. If I was living over there, wouldn't I want to try anything to get to a country where I could sleep at night without having people kick my door in and shoot me and throw bombs at me? I mean, you know, we've become...
I still don't see how you can say that Christianity is a bigger enemy than Islam.
It's the fifth column. It's the definite fifth column in this country. Christianity has done more to weaken the white race than anything else, other than materialism, and of course Christianity has used that. I would take the tax exemption away from every church in this country overnight if I had the power to do it, and then you'd find Christianity shrink to a very small...
What about communism? Communism doesn't exist, it's just a myth?
Communism was always controlled by the capitalists. I mean, it was supported, financed, and everything by the capitalists. Russia was a state capitalist country. It took millions of people out of competition with the West and the labor market and so forth like that. So communism was, communism's not even possible. It was a type of socialism, but it was communism only worked in a tribal situation. You couldn't possibly run a big country.
Well, that doesn't matter. The point is what it was promoting, you know, the fact that it doesn't work, of course it doesn't, but it was a big fraud, but what it was promoting...
Wait a minute.
It's pretty bad.
Why did the people rise up in Russia? Was there no reason for it? Was everything wonderful in Russia?
Now you're gonna defend the Bolsheviks?
Well, there was millions of other people that rose up, not just the Bolsheviks. The Bolsheviks were taken in there from New York to cause problems, but there was massive dissatisfaction among the people in Russia. And that's how the Bolsheviks were able to pull it off. They were going along with the dissatisfaction of the masses in Russia. I mean, communism only gets a foothold when the people are real unhappy and they got nowhere else to turn. Look at the communism in South America. It's because of capitalist exploitation many times. They turn to communism. Not because it's good, but it's because the only thing that's left around for these indigenous people to cling on to. If we didn't live in an empire that's, moving in on people all over the world and robbing their resources and everything else, these people wouldn't go communist. They don't want to go communist. They want to be just left alone.
Well, of course, nobody's left alone. So are you still agreeing, Tan?
I am. I find myself, I'm an anti-globalist, and I wasn't originally. You know, the right wing loves globalism and loves commerce and capitalism and tries to make communism.
But that's not
communism.
The right wing I'm talking about. I'm not a right winger like that either. I'm talking about racialism, nationalism. I'm talking about national and racialism, and that seems to be getting lost here with people who say they don't want to talk about left and right, but just keep doing it.
Well, would you agree to cut the military budget down to about 20% of what it is now?
Sure, I would.
Yeah.
I'm not a Republican type right winger.
On the same page there. What about global warming? What do you think?
Oh, I don't put any stock in global warming. I don't know what that is. Now, I know you're an environmentalist, but I don't really want to get into environmentalism.
I'm a conservation. I'm all for global warming because I think it's going to do a great job for us. It's going to be one of our allies. If it's true, it's our ally because it's going to cause massive upheaval around the world. It's going to do a wipe out many, many third world countries. And it's going to the capitalists are going to run out of anything to exploit. And we're going to move back into tribalism and something that we could win. So I think global warming may be a very good idea.
Well, I don't know if there really is any global warming. But about violence. Do you advocate violence? People think you do. That's what the idea of you is, that you advocate violence, and you have.
Well, there are different kinds of violence. There's intelligent violence and there's unintelligent violence. People who commit unintelligent violence are not good.
Those people who killed that Ethiopian with a baseball bat when he was standing? I don't think he had done anything to them. They just saw him from what the stories are. Now you can straighten that out. And these were people that were, what would you say? I can't come up with the word now. You know, they are acolytes of yours or something. That's not the right word, but were, you know, they killed that guy. They said in court because he was because of his race. Violence.
You bought into the D's thing yourself, because what actually happened was some of these skinheads had a meeting with their girlfriends in an apartment. The meeting broke up. Those four guys got into a car and they were going down the street, and there was a car blocking the street with four Ethiopians in it. And when they were asked to move, they wouldn't move. They'd been drinking and say, you know, go to hell and like that. So one guy, white guy, crawls out of the car, gets into a fight, but he's getting mauled by these other people. And the guy that got killed was already half a block away going into his house. He wasn't even in the fight in the beginning. He ran back to get into the fight. These three guys or so are beating the hell out of the skinheads, and the one guy gets out of forgot his name now, but anyhow, he gets out of the car, takes a board and beats the Ethiopian over the head and kills him.
I thought he had a baseball bat.
Well, maybe it was a baseball bat. A stick of wood, whatever it was, it don't make any difference. But the point is, it was unfortunate, but it probably would have happened even if it was white people fighting white people. It's just a street fight. That's all it was.
I looked that up, and I did not find that version anywhere. Now, you're not doing a good job getting that version out. Why don't you have that version out somewhere?
People ask me, and I tell them. If you contact, there are people, even ex-cops in Portland, Oregon, that would tell you the same thing. And that book, 100 Hitlers by Eleanor Langer, I think brings that out. And she happens to be Jewish too, and she did a very good job on that book.
I read something, but they didn't give that part of it. They just gave a part of her book. So, you know, isn't that in the court documents? So why couldn't that be published?
Let me tell you exactly what happened. When they were first charged, these guys, They had a researcher, a guy that an investigator, go out. He gathered all this information, and in the meantime, they brought these guys into the DA's office up there, and the feds came into the office, and they said, "Well, look, either you plead guilty to this thing, or we're going to try you again on federal charges, and you'll never get out of prison. These are teenage kids." So they had the DA saying, "We're going to get you for maybe 20 years or whatever," and the feds saying, "Yeah, and if they don't get you, we're going to get you for 40 or 50 years." So they were scared. They pled guilty, and that was the end of it. It's a
filthy
lawsuit.
Yeah, so that's why that guy said, Ken, I think, testified that he killed that man because of his race, when actually, instead of saying that he killed him because he was... his friend's life was in danger or whatever, you know.
Well, by that time, Ken Miske was so pissed and at the whole thing and the whole world. I don't know. It's a wonder what he did say. All I know is I had nothing to do with those guys. I'd never met him or anything else. I was dragged into it, but out of honor and loyalty to a white racist, I defended those guys as long as I could. Even when a judge told me, he said, "Look, separate yourself from these guys, and this is no case." But I wouldn't do it. I even bought them suits and clothes to come into court in, because I believe in honor and standing up for my people. And even though they made a big mistake there, and if they'd listened, if they had known me and listened to me, they wouldn't have gotten in that mess. But once it happened, then there's guys in prison I write all the time that they made mistakes, and some of them made some pretty bad mistakes, but they're still my race. Well,
they do. There's this tendency to get violent, and it happens over and over and over again with whites.
Let me say something.
Well,
it works. Ethnic cleansing works, and it works because the people get the idea that they're not welcome, and so they leave. And the problem is that our system is set up to be anti-white. Whites are the ones being ethnically cleansed at the moment by this under the auspices of this current regime. And Tom said something in the Louis and the Nazis documentary that I found very, very true. He made this point to Louis that whites, when we're brought up on charges, the charges are trumped up, they're exaggerated. And in this case, it's not only the charges against the guys who were brought up for murder, it's the way they linked it to Tom then. And this idea of that he was civilly liable for it. Am I correct? This is the Oregon trial. And what came out of it was the way they bankrupted you was they said that you were civilly liable under this doctrine of what's called vicarious liability, in which one can be liable for a tort committed by a subordinate or by another person who is taking instructions. And you're saying these guys, you didn't know these guys. You certainly didn't tell them to do this. But this is
I didn't have an organization. I had no members. There were no members in the organization. There was no organization. I mean, this was just, and then you wonder why I am so hateful of the powerful and rich, because they trump these things up. They had parades in the street, hang Metzger, hang these guys. They had, all the civil wrongs, people from all over the country, to where there was no chance. John, my son, and I knew we were going to lose a case because it was so Trump. It was totally Trump. And the lies that came out in that courtroom were such big lies, it took a stupid jury to believe them. I mean, I don't have time to go through all the lies in that courtroom.
Well, this is where, we torture ourselves by saying, well, what are we doing wrong? And what could we have done better? We have a system that's stacked against us. We can't forget that. And that's where our anger and our energy should be directed against is that system and the people that back that system. Not at each other pointing fingers at each other saying, you could have done this better and you could have done that better.
There still is a lot of violence. I don't care. There has been a lot of violence, unnecessary violence, carried out. Well, I think they're kind of maybe – I think what happens is that they're provoked into it, and then it looks like it's
Carolyn,
called unnecessary.
Carolyn, that's a ridiculous thing to say. The amount of criminal violence from the skinheads or racist people has been on a head of a pin compared to the violence of the niggers and everybody else, and the government who's dropping bombs on everybody in the goddamn world and droning people and killing whole families and everything else, and they have the gall to point their finger at the very few incidents of racist violence in this country.
Yeah, but our guys always go to prison for it, so it doesn't pay off.
No, they don't. How do you know that? How do you know what's going on? If I have lone wolves and leaderless resistance, how do you know what's going on? You think you know what's going on. If you don't see something on the front page and the headlines say, oh, there's nothing happening, that's a typical right-wing thing to say. That's a typical right-wing to say because the right wing had never learned how to use deception and trickery and infiltration and so forth like that. And until they learn, they're going to have to learn the hard way. Violence. This whole country is violent from one end to the other. Look at the New Orleans yesterday. 19 people shot by these crazy niggers. You know, but they don't want to talk about that hardly at all.
I understand that.
Yeah,
all the gun laws are being promoted because mostly non-white crime. I mean, you know, and they're using that as a reason to try to get the guns. There's a hell of a lot of white people. I think they should get their guns away from them because if they're evangelical Christian crazies, when it comes down to a fight, they're going to come gunning for me. I've heard them talk. These guys,
you're not really racialist. You're not, because if these white people are Christian, then they're no good, or this or that, they're no good. And you like, the people, it has to be a certain kind of white people that are in your political spectrum. And,
Okay, if we end up with one third of the white people surviving in this country, that's fine with me, because a hell of a lot of those people are going to be our worst enemies as time goes on. They would join in posses to hunt us down. They'll get on juries and throw us in prison and everything else. They have lost their right to be white or call themselves white. I don't refer to them as white. I refer to Aryans as the nobility of our race. The rest of them can go fish.
Well, what about all the non-whites that you accept as noble?
Well, if a non-white is a noble person, I respect him as a noble person. I want separation. I don't want domination. I don't want to kill black people. I don't want to kill even Mexicans or any of these people. I want separation. And if we get the government off our ass, we'd have separation. So I'm not going. So that's why I can go into a black meeting and talk to these people. And I can go into places like that and be accepted as being an honest man because they trust me that I'm not going to lie to them. That we're all under the gun.
Do you think you're having a real influence?
I don't know. I don't know. I just get up every day and do what I do and let the chips fall where they may. I don't sit around and think about it. Mm-hmm. Hopefully I have some influence. I think I've reached enough young people over the years, over the decades, that many of them have grown into leadership positions, and many of them have gone into science and the law and the military and all this kind of stuff, and they're people in higher positions now, and they're totally undercover. They're totally lone wolves. They will not contact me under any considerations. If they did, I'd try to pop them in the nose. I've told people, get deceptive. Get in there, infiltrate, pretend you're the other side.
But you don't know what they are. You don't know what they're doing.
Well, that's right, but nobody else does either. Nobody else does either. No, that's the way it has to get to, you know, and that's what you call real warfare. It's the war in the shadows is what I call it.
Okay, I want to bring up something here. I'll try to be brief. Shouldn't take more than 5 minutes. Then Tan can carry on with some things with you, I hope. And then that is the New Orleans Protocol. You know, supposedly there was, in 2004, New Orleans, a meeting at the European American Unity and Leadership Conference. Is that David Duke's group? Anyway, in New Orleans. And eight leaders of large pro-white groups agreed to something they call this Protocol Against Violence. They said that the first principle, there had three principles. The first principle was zero tolerance within our cause for violence or suggested violence. And these eight people were Willis Carto, Sam G. Dixon, Dr. Edward Fields, Kevin Alfred Strome, John Tyndall, who's British, Paul Frome, Canadian, David Pringle, he's the only one I'm not sure who he is, and David Duke, PhD. They have to put PhD after his name. They said that they would agree to a zero-tolerance policy toward violence, which was essential to protecting white racialist groups from the sort of agent provocateur or unhinged violence that our people's enemies routinely use to destroy white nationalist groups. Well, they do use that. They do make sure that if they do anything, that they play it up real big. And then they said the second principle was to always maintain a high moral tone and things like that. So what would you – third principle was that they would refrain from attacking one another. I'm not too good at that. Refrain from attacking leaders or supporters of other effective white groups, even if you didn't quite agree with what they were saying. So.
Well, those kind of meetings are money-gathering meetings. Get people together, one side's trying to recruit members from the other side and the whole bit. They gloss it over with unity. There's no unity in the right. There never was. And I go back to the very beginning. I know where all the skeletons are at in the closets. And let me tell you something. Anybody that's stupid enough to say they would never employ violence is too stupid even to work with. I would never respect any person that says, under no condition would I ever use violence. I mean, that the Jews...
Well, I left out that the distinction between violence and self-defense was made clear. Okay.
How
you can
clear?
Defend yourself. Well,
sometimes defending yourself is getting up earlier in the morning and doing the other guy before he does you. What do you say about that?
Well, I don't know, but they...
Do you have to wait till somebody attacks you that you know is going to attack you? Somebody's going to kill you?
I guess
somebody
so.
Somebody planning to do you in, and you're supposed to say, well, I'll wait till he attacks me, and then I'll defend myself? No, nobody ever won that way. Nobody ever won that. You think I'm going around advocating willy-nilly violence? No, I never did. I've never been in prison, never been convicted of a felony. I just believe that violence is, in the nature of things, something that is used. If it's used intelligently against the right enemy, then it's very advantageous. And at some point, you got to use it. But not against some lone black guy standing on a corner or Mexican or anything like that. I'm talking about going for the throat of the system.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You understand what I'm talking about?
Well, sure. But I don't agree with this random acts of...
Burn down Washington, D.C. That's a good start.
Yeah.
And then go down to the Pentagon and burn that son of a bitch down, too. And I think I got a lot of radical left-wingers who would agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
See, I am radical. I'm sorry. I am radical. I don't have an army, but I want things to happen, and it's not going to happen the easy way. You're not going to pretty please them. You're not going to vote anybody in or out. I played that game for 30 years and lost every time. Not that I was a wonderful guy or anything, but I learned how it operated. And the whole political system is a sham. It's a shell game. It's a way of holding power without sharing power. It all boils down to the people rising up and taking control.
Well, that's where you can worry about if they're the people are going to do what you want or if they're going to be against what you want. That gets kind of hairy, but you know, you are a promoter of a violent reaction or whatever you might want, violent revolutionary action. But at the same time, you've been running for office and you like to run for office. I was saying that before you came on. You ran again in 2011 after your ones in the 80s. So how do you,
that was a local deal. I should have never done it. It was a write-in deal. I was stupid to do that, and I regretted doing that. So anyhow, but the others, I learned a lot from the others. I learned how the game was played. I rubbed shoulders with a lot of some powerful people, and I learned how they play the game and how the citizens are so misled by these people and how rotten and corrupt they are on all sides. They're all corrupt. It's all organized crime. Yeah, it's the mob in Washington. There's no government there. It's organized crime. And so I decided that, and also it allowed me, when I ran for office, to reach people or meet some people that became very effective outside politics, if you get my drift.
Well, in 2011, you said it was such a mistake. Why was it such a mistake? I mean, you can share your views. You can put ads on radio and TV, right?
If you think political parties have a lock on things in big cities, here in central Indiana, in northern Indiana, the Republicans have such a lock on this state that it's impossible for anybody. There's no Democrat. Of course, they run on such stupid platforms anyhow, but even an honest Democrat couldn't get anywhere in this state. It's a Republican police state in Indiana, and that's all it is.
You've always ran on as a Democrat, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, not always. A couple of times in the very beginning, I run for local offices that were non-denominational.
Yeah. But anyhow, you're a lone wolf, all right. You know, you're very individualistic. You're not like anybody else, and nobody's like you. So go ahead and say what you want to say, and then I'm going to let Tan finish up here.
Well, Carolyn, I'd just like to ask you, where do you draw the little red line like Obama? How far would you tolerate the system going without becoming somewhat violent? How far would it go? How far are you going to let it go?
I'm not against violence. I'm not against violence.
Oh, okay. Then we agree.
No, I didn't mean to. I'm just trying to clarify with you. I was thinking that Stormfront, New Orleans Protocol was funny myself.
Well, look, let me tell you something. Those leaders that go to those meetings, I know all of those people go to those meetings. I know all about them. I know all about their past. They all represent maybe 50 or 100 people maximum. They get into these deals. They have a couple of drinks and they give speeches. And I've been to.
I know.
But I've been to them forever, and nothing ever comes out of them. You know.
Right.
So what they decided there meant nothing.
Well, they want to get respect. As though that's ever going to get us anywhere, because I understand that it's only power that counts, but I don't think we have any power.
It's However, also money. The right wing has always loved the money too. Believe me, Willis Cardo ran off with the Gene Farrell fortune, the Edison fortune. Willis Cardo ran off with all the money and he split it with his Australian partner. I knew all about it. I knew the people. I talked to the people.
Well, he lost right there in court, so he had to pay it. He had to pay it back to the IHR.
Oh, hell.
Right?
He had money. He had money hidden away all the world. His wife had money hidden in banks in Europe and all that.
I think so.
Believe me. He's still got plenty of money. I was in the courtroom when they found him liable. And guess who he called to the stand to be his best friend witness? Who's the guy that wrote about the Kennedy assassination, the first book about it?
Michael Collins Piper.
His
lawyer. Yeah, Mark. The Jew.
The big Jew.
Yeah.
Yeah, super Jew as well as Cardo Nazis. Best buddy.
Well, everybody stands up for him as a great guy, even though he's Jewish. He's one of the Jews that you would like. You know, you say they're not all bad.
I don't think so. I have a little bit. I don't think so, but I don't know for sure. I never talked to him.
I just mean for them, he's one of those.
I'll tell you one I liked, and I don't know whether he was Jewish, and that was Gore Vidal. I have a lot of respect for Gore Vidal. In fact, I ran against him in 82 for United States Senate in a field of 9. I never got to debate him, but I read a lot of his books, and he has a lot of good populist ideas.
Yeah, I kind of like him, too. And I think if he's Jewish, he's only part Jewish. I'm not even sure if he is.
I don't think he is Jewish.
Yeah. Okay, Tan, what have you got left?
But even if he was Jewish, if he said the truth, and I recognized the truth, I would say, well, that's the truth. I'm not going to say because a Jew says something, it's absolutely always got to be a lie. I've got friends like that, that everything is Jew. The Jews do everything bad. And I say, wait a minute. I mean, they're only 2% and they have tremendous power, but there's tremendous amount of other people of all the races got a lot of power.
Nobody's power like the Jews. That's just the way it is. Nobody does.
You don't know how the Jews fight among themselves. If you would read more Israeli newspapers, listen to Israeli...
I know they argue. They argue among themselves.
They do argue among themselves.
They tell each other, too.
But the big advantage that they have is that they're arguing about what's best for the Jews. Two Jews, three opinions about what's best for the Jews. But whereas white people argue about other things.
Or what's best for their criminal enterprise is what you should say.
Yeah, yeah.
Judaism is a criminal enterprise. That's all it is a criminal enterprise.
How come there's those Jews that aren't supposed to be criminals that go along with them and help them?
Because they're in a bind. The average Jew, the working class Jew. I've talked to Jews around the country.
How come the white working class white person is not in a bind in following their own people? Well, maybe
because
they are.
No
there was.
Remember the Klan in the South? they kept white people in line pretty well. I mean, you know, there has to be some reverse power there to encourage people to do the right thing. I mean, if you want white people to do the right thing, you got to guide them in the right way, and sometimes you have to set an example. You know, that's the Jews through all those Jews in World War II, as far as I'm concerned, the hierarchy of Zionism didn't really care at all, because it got them what they wanted. They're only interested in the ends justify the means. So they lost a few hundred thousand Jews. So what? We got Israel.
Well, Hitler, you and I have some differences about Hitler. I was just going to say, but I was not bringing it up, but I'm going to just turn this over to Tan because he hasn't, got enough chance here. If he wants to bring it up, he can.
No, I don't want to talk about Hitler. That's your specialty, but please have another show and have Tom on to talk about that. You guys could talk about that for 2 hours, I'm sure. In these last few minutes, I want to bring it back to leaderless resistance and lone wolf.
Yes.
And my understanding of it is very favorable. I read Louis Beam's Leaderless Resistance essay. He makes a very good case there. And as you have for Lone Wolf, it's a pragmatic reaction to the reality of the world. The anti-white system that will persecute you and prosecute you for even imaginary links that they can find between you and anyone who does commit violence. This idea of not having those links, not explicitly avoiding those links, is a good reaction to that. But at the same time, I see this New Orleans Protocol as a flip side of the same coin. Those guys are just taking a different approach to the same reality, which is, if we're going to be punished for having links and having violence, well, one of those two things has to go. You know, you say the links have to go and keep the violence. Those guys say, we want the links and we want to have the organizations, so the violence has to go. What do you think about that, Tom?
Well, if they didn't want problems, they shouldn't have had the meeting in the first place because it's full of informants. Anyhow, there was the point I was going to make there, and now I've missed out on it. I forget what I was going to say. It's something you said, too. Now go on. Maybe I'll think of it. But I'm telling you, all these meetings are nothing but money-raising deals. And as far as this prom from Canada, he's so limp-wristed, I don't know. These people, they're not going to fight. They're going to talk. They're going to talk forever. And if it comes down to physical violence, forget it. I was with Duke on the firing line at Camp Pendleton, California. And some black gal from the Socialist Workers Party ran through the crowd and hit him upside the head with a cardboard placard, and he almost cried. I mean, so I learned early on what most of these leaders are like. They won't fight. I fought in the streets. I took my men into the streets when I thought that was the thing to do. And we fought the Reds all over California. And so, and we beat them too. And then I never had a man sent to jail because of my street activity. I never had a man seriously injured because of my street activity. But I wouldn't do it now. You see, let me give you the example here. I've known the Mahon brothers out in Oklahoma for years, and, you know, they've been around, they've been in and out of this kind of group and that kind of group. We've sort of been loose friends. We haven't, we didn't see each other much or anything else. Well, anyhow, then the, Mahon gets charged with this sending this letter bomb to this crazy ass deal down in Arizona. And all of a sudden, I got feds out front of my house, ATF. They had 9 guys with machine guns, local cops, federal cops. There must have been 20 cars out there. They come past, brush past me and my wife into my house, tear my house upside down, take my computers and everything else just because I knew the Mahons. There was not one shred of evidence that I was involved with anybody building any bombs or anything else, because if I tried to build a bomb, I'd probably kill myself. But
well,
anyhow...
That was the claim that I read, was that you had supplied them with bomb-making instructions, which is something
right.
In this day and age you can get, anyone can get it off the Internet.
Well, what they probably meant was that maybe at one time I had books in my library and books for sale that, what was that one back in
the
Anarchist booklet. But believe me, the Mahon boys, they knew a hell of a lot more about all that stuff than I did. They didn't have to get it from me. These feds know I'm a smart guy. I'm not running around supplying people with bomb material and telling them to send a damn letter bomb to a little Negro down in Phoenix. I mean, that's an insult to my intelligence. And they know that.
Yeah.
In fact, they stood around. Some of the feds stood around. They were obviously embarrassed because they found there's nothing here. There was nothing in my house. Nothing that could put me into anything, because I'm not into that. I'm in to stop the government from bombing people, bombing us. Because eventually they'll have drones over my house here, probably.
Well, I'm very glad you came to talk with us, Tom. You've opened my eyes to quite a few things here to think about. And we just have 30 seconds left. Carolyn, you want to close
us
out?
Well, no, I'm glad you've got some new things to think about, Dan. I think that's great. And I enjoyed it very much, too, Tom. You're a real nice guy, and you're an easy talker and so on. And I certainly have a lot of respect for you, too.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the invite, and I think we had a healthy discourse here.
Yeah, we covered quite a bit. So I want to thank you, and thanks to the listeners. Everybody can say goodbye if you want.
Goodbye.
14-5. 14-5.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.